AirVenture Oshkosh always attracts the best of the best, and our next guest tonight at Theater in the Woods is a legend, an all-American naval aviator, Gemini and Apollo astronaut. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Captain Jim Lovell.
There you go, revenue.
So how are you doing this evening?
Pardon?
How are you doing this evening?
Oh, how am I doing? I'm doing quite well. I had a very enjoyable short time here. I always want to support the Gathering of the Eagles mm-hmm. and the young people who take an enthusiastic part in aviation. I've enjoyed it all my life, and I hope that I can pass that on to the young people who think that they would like to go into aviation or even into space. It's a quite unique feeling, and so... It's always good to be up here once a year to, kick tires, light fires, talk over old times. I've met a lot of old friends that, and they keep getting older, you notice that? So it's fine for me to be here.
Well, you mentioned young people. How did you get your start?
Well, it was kind of interesting. I mentioned it just briefly last night at the banquet, but I had never flown anything, but when I was about 8 years old, my father had an opportunity to take me up in their little company airplane. It was a biplane of some sort, and so we flew around. The pilot flew us around, and then we landed. And that was the only flight experience I ever had at that particular age. But my uncle was a early naval aviator, number 58, as a matter of fact, way back in the teens of last century. And every time he'd come to the house, he would talk to us about flying off those very early aircraft carriers and the biplanes and what the Navy had. And I was very enthusiastic about flying. But when I was graduating in high school, what I really wanted to become was a rocket engineer, because I had started to get quite interested in rockets and what Goddard here in the American had done and what von Braun had finally found out about that just after the war. But I didn't have any money to go to college to take up courses that would lead me to rocket engineering. I did get an appointment, though, in the Navy, in the ROTC, to a naval aviation program. This was just after World War II. And so I went to the University of Wisconsin. I'm from Milwaukee. I went there for 2 years. Went down to Pensacola for flight training. When I got an appointment to the Naval Academy, so I decided to get all my education at one time and get that get that over with. And so I took the appointment and went back to the Academy for 4 years. And when I graduated from there, I went into flight training right down to Pensacola to become a naval aviator.
So how did you find the Academy? Did you enjoy your time there?
Well, I didn't enjoy the plebe year. But, the Naval Academy is a really fine institution, and it's a great place to be from. The primary purpose of the Academy is to develop competent military officers. So any young people who desire to want to go there, remember that that is the military. That's your primary purpose when you go there. But it is a very good educational institution now, and much better than when I went there in 48 to 52. I mean, the academics are superb, just as good as any Ivy League school or state university. So if you want to go there and have a chance, I think it's well worthwhile.
In the movie Apollo 13, there's an interview with Tom Hanks, who's playing you, talking about an incident that happened at night. You're flying over the ocean. You lost all of your instrument lights. And I know that Hollywood sometimes takes liberties with stories like that, but is that a true story?
Oh, that's absolutely true. When I was a naval aviator, I was in a squadron called VC-3. This was back in the 50s. Now, the Navy had not developed squadrons that fly at night. They do now, of course, over in the Middle East. Most of their activity is at night. But in those days, we only flew at night when we had to. And so what the Navy did was to send out teams to the carriers, not squadrons. a team of what we call the big prop plane, the ADs, the Douglas AD, and then jets, which were the at that time called the Banshees, the Banshee 3s. There would be four airplanes, five pilots, and about 30 people to help support all that. And that was the night fighting contingent of carriers back in the early 50s. And so I got my wings, and I thought I would be going to a day squadron when I found out I was going to a night fighter squadron. And when I got to the squadron, I asked the skipper, I said, you know, I have a hard time flying at daytime. What's this nighttime stuff off of aircraft carriers? But anyway, I deployed on a team going out to the West Pacific. And one night when I took off, I can remember distinctly, it was February 3rd. We took off and the weather was getting bad. And finally, after the three of the four planes had taken off for a night, what we call a cap, you know, over the task force, they canceled the flight. And as I was coming back, the Homer that I had, which was ADF in those days, was locked onto a frequency or a station in Japan rather than the ship. So I missed the ship completely, couldn't find the ship. They were not pinging me on radar, and I was heading for Japan. My other two companions had already found the ship and were orbiting the ship when I did a 180, and I had developed a knee pad that I thought was a very good invention on the way over to the Western Pacific. But when I plugged it into the ship's receptacle, I blew out all the fuses in the cockpit. It went completely dark. And now the weather was coming in, there was no horizon. I had a little pen light that I stuck in my mouth that only showed one instrument at a time. And so I was decided to reverse my course to come back to see if I could just find the ship somehow. And the way I found it was because it was so dark that I saw the fluorescence on the waters churned up by the algae of the screws of the big ship coming down. And so I followed the trail all the way back to where the carrier was, and that's how I got back.
I don't know about you, but I think the story coming from him is a lot better than the new movie. You also set a couple of jet speed records in the Navy, I believe?
No, the only real record that I hold is in the space program. It's a record that will not be broken until we go to Mars. I hold, along with my two companions on Apollo 13, the absolute altitude record. I don't care what kind of airplane you have and how high you go, I hold the absolute altitude record, something like 248,655 miles, give or take a mile or two, because on a 13, since we didn't slow down around the moon, but we went by it until the moon's gravity could swing us back to get back home again, we went farther out than anybody else has ever gone from the Earth until, I guess, we probably go to Mars or something like that.
Sure. Well, you're in, yeah. So you're in the Navy, you're flying off carriers at night. How do you make the jump from that to the space program?
Going into space was kind of interesting because you're looking at somebody who was in the original selection group for Mercury. Now, of the seven Mercury astronauts, only two are still alive, so I feel kind of lucky that I was in that original selection. I went into test pilot school, and I was just finishing up the school itself. I'd been assigned to one of the centers at Patuxent River, Maryland, when NASA, which was formed from the old NACA, decided to go operational and try to figure out putting somebody into Earth orbit. So they President Eisenhower suggested the type of individual to select. He said, take test pilots because they are used to testing airplanes and spacecraft will be just an addition to what they have been used to. And they all have security clearances, which at that time we needed security clearances. And so NASA went to both the Navy and the Air Force, and they gave a list of criteria of what you had to have. Essentially in those days, you had to have an engineering degree. You had to have about 1,000 hours of flying jets, and I don't know why that was a criteria, but that was in the case a long time ago. You couldn't be over the age of 35. You couldn't be over 6 feet tall. And you had to be a graduate of a test pilot school. There were three, Air Force, Navy, and the Empire Test School in UK. And out of the computers of the personnel of the, both the Air Force and the Navy, 110 individuals came up with that criteria. So the NASA sent out invitations to go to Washington in groups of 40. And I was on the first group of 40 to go to Washington to finally get briefed. This is all sort of still in the security type mode. And they told us about going into space on a capsule on top of an Atlas booster. And I don't know if you remember in those days, but Atlas boosters were blowing up every other day down at Cape Canaveral. This is going to be the Project Mercury. Well, after that, they took 32 of the 100 of the 40, actually the whole 110 actually, and we went out to Albuquerque for our physicals. And out of the 32, they picked the original seven, which you all know, the Glens and the Shepherds and the Grissoms and those people. But I was then reselected 2 years later when they were looking at a second group. They called me back and said, would you like to try again? And I said, sure, why not? And so I got in the second group.
So you're in the Gemini program. You were on Gemini 7 and 12, if I am correct. Any events on either of those missions that kind of stand out as...
Well, Gemini 7 was a flight to determine if man could stay in space for 2 weeks. That was the maximum length of time to fly from the Earth to the Moon and back again, as they had programmed. Now, a lot of doctors didn't think that we would survive zero gravity for 2 weeks because, if you recall, we evolved under the influence of gravity. So they all thought there were some functions of the human body that would rely on gravity so we could exist. Well, it turns out that we don't need gravity to stay alive. All the body functions keep going just like they do in a gravitational environment. And so we proved that 2 weeks was not a long time to stay in space. And I think today, I think there's several Russians that have been in space for over a year. Now, things do happen. When you go into space, for the first 6 hours, your head feels full. Much like if you're a youngster and you leaned over a bar and you put your head down when blood would rush into your head. And the reason, basically, is the heart doesn't understand that it's in a zero-gravity environment, so it's pumping away as if it still has to pump blood up against a pressure up to the head to keep it from fainting. And all of a sudden, something in the brain tells the heart, hey, you don't have to work as hard. Slow down. So the heart slows down about 10 beats per minute slower than it does on Earth. If your heart is now at, say, 70 beats, it will go down to about 60 in zero gravity under the same circumstances. Leg muscles also deteriorate quite rapidly because we're not using the legs. As a matter of fact, one of the early ideas for astronauts was to take a double amputee. He doesn't need the legs, so why have that excess weight? Because every day that you walk, you're strengthening your legs, whether you like it or not. Not your arms so much, unless you're in that type of a business that you need arm muscles. But your legs are strengthened because one of the things the legs do, and the leg muscles, is tighten up the arteries and the veins going down to your legs to prevent them from slowly opening up and having all the blood flow down to your legs, and therefore, of course, you would faint. But when in zero gravity, there was no gravity to work against to keep the legs strong, and so quite fast, the legs deteriorate, and you had to be careful about coming back to Earth. Not so much being up in space, but coming back to Earth and suddenly getting under the influence of Earth gravity and having the veins and the arteries spread out and blood flowing into your legs. So now, in the shuttle and or actually in the space station and for long flights, Exercise is very, very important to keep your body in tune, not so much to live in space, but is to get ready for the return home.
Interesting. Any good, we're going to go from science to something funny maybe, any good pranks that either were pulled on you or you pulled on your fellow astronauts during missions?
Well, there was one that we had. This was Gemini 7. It took off in December. The Army-Navy game was coming up. And we were going to rendezvous with Gemini 6, the very first rendezvous in space, which is part of the training for the eventual Apollo missions. In Gemini 7, I was the pilot, the commander at that time was Frank Borman. He was from West Point. In Gemini 6 that we were going to rendezvous with was Tom Stafford, Air Force, but graduated at that time from the Naval Academy, and Wally Schirra, Naval Academy graduate. So as we rendezvoused and we finally got together and we looked at each other, Tom Stafford held up a sign that said, "Beat Army." I took the picture, and poor Frank Borman, being a captive West Pointer, couldn't do anything about it. The highest Beat Army rally ever known to man.
With the conclusion of the Gemini program, we move into Apollo. I'm sure many of us remember the Apollo 8 mission, the Christmas Eve broadcast. As you were going around the moon, what kind of emotions or feelings were going through your head at that time?
Well, Apollo 8 was the high point, really, of my space career. First time that three people left the confines of the Earth to circle a foreign body. First time that we were able to look live on the far side of the moon, which we never see from the Earth. First time to see the Earth as it actually is, a small body, going around a rather normal star, our sun, nothing spectacular about it, and our sun is tucked away in the outer edge of the universe. So it was really kind of awe-inspiring. You could put your thumb up and completely hide the moon, or hide the Earth, rather, behind your thumb. And you all have to think about that for a while, because everything that I'd ever known, homeland, problems, everything else is behind your thumb. And it really, determined that how insignificant we all are on this small body, but also how this is also a spacecraft. And it has limited resources, and we're all astronauts, whether you like it or not. You're not wearing spacesuits, but you have this nice environment, this atmosphere above you, and resources below you, but they're limited. And as time goes on, we're going to have to start changing things, and we already know that by the oil reserves that we have. So you have to think about in terms of survival and what's going to happen to the Earth in the future.
From the success of Apollo 8, of course, the probably most famous mission would be Apollo 13. The movie Apollo 13, I'm sure most of us have seen it. The movie itself, how much of that is Hollywood and how much was really what had happened?
Surprisingly, the movie of Apollo 13 is a very, very accurate movie for those of you who have seen it. There's three things in there that I will tell you about that were not quite accurate, but most of the incidents were true. There was a little artistic license taken into the beginning of the movie. That sequence when Jack Swigert, who replaced Ken Manley because we thought he was going to come down with the measles, which he never did, by the way. Everybody said that since he did not train for the last 2 months before the liftoff, because of the fact he was taking care of our guests coming down, being the backup, and we sort of hogged all the computers and the simulators, that suddenly he's on board, that the movie sort of depicted him as having to earn his wings every day. Well, it turned out that he was a very competent pilot. He actually wrote the malfunction procedures for the command module, which had the explosion. So if there's anybody else that we really wanted to have on board, that would be him. The second artistic license was at the end of the movie when it appeared that Ken Manley, who was kicked off the flight, was the one that solved the electrical problem to power up the little battery in the command module so that we could power it back up again and make a safe landing back through the atmosphere on the Earth. Actually, he was only one of about four people working on that problem, and he'll be the first to tell you that it wasn't his really idea to begin with, but he was just helping with everybody else. The only thing that was not true in the movie was the oral argument between Swigert and Hayes about throwing the switch that caused the explosion. There wasn't any argument concerning that at all, but Ron Howard had to show anxiety and stress, and he thought the best way to do it with an oral confrontation rather than just showing perspiration coming down in your face. And so other than that, the movie, all the incidents are true. The one thing that the movie critics really complained to Ron Howard, the director, about was the sequence where my wife lost her wedding ring down the drain in the motel. They said, why did you put that in? You don't have to hype up this movie. And Howard said, I didn't hype up this movie. That was a true statement. And it was. My wife really lost her ring down the rain the day before. She was very much superstitious, didn't like the number 13 anyway. But what the movie doesn't show is that about 2 hours later, the plumber came in and took the trap off and found the ring.
So you're back from Apollo 13, and you continued your career in NASA until, I believe, 1973, right, when you retired. What have you been doing since then?
Well, that's kind of an interesting story. I guess I've retired about three or four times. I stayed with NASA, and I worked with the early design of the orbiters. I did some of the human engineering in the cockpits, the layout of the cockpits, and I was an early advocate of having sidearm controllers for the orbiter, like we have now on some of the F-16 and some of the private airplanes. We just saw some of the newer aircraft. But I was overruled, and now they have that big stick right in the middle of the orbiter, which is still a force-type stick. But then I went into Earth Resources, since we are also going to develop the shuttle as a sort of the space station until we actually built the space station. And I worked there for about 3 years. The last thing I did there was I went to Harvard for the Advanced Management Program, and I learned just enough about business to be dangerous. And so at that time I retired from NASA, and retired from the Navy and left NASA. I got in the tugboat business. Since I was a Navy officer, I thought that maybe I should know something about ships. But I knew nothing about ships. I knew more about airplanes. I got in that, and then I left that, and I finally got in the telephone industry and was in that for some time. And then a young man by the name of Jeff Kluger wrote me a letter and said, I've always wanted to write a book. I never have written one, but I thought Apollo 13 would be interesting. Would you help me? And that's something I always wanted to do. So we got together to write a book called Lost Moon, and just after one chapter was written, Ron Howard picked up the option to do the movie, and when Tom Hanks heard that Ron Howard, the director, had an option to do a movie on Apollo 13, Hanks being a closet astronaut, he was a space enthusiast for many years, actually lobbied Howard to be in the movie, which is sort of unusual. He had just won an Oscar for Forrest Gump, and then I think he won another one for Philadelphia, or Philadelphia first, then Forrest Gump. So he even decided he'd take a cut in pay to do the job. I told Howard that I'd be more than happy to take a cut in pay, and his cut went down to, a paltry $12.5 million, I think, for that movie. I often chastise him. I see him every once in a while. He's a great, great guy, a great friend. I said, Tom, you know, you did Apollo 13 with smoke and mirrors, and I did the real thing, and I didn't get anywhere near that.
So So you didn't get the big paycheck for having the cameo at the end of the movie either?
Oh, I was in the beginning of, or the end of the movie. End. That's right. When the movie was being produced, Ron Howard came to me and said, "Would you like to be in this movie? Like a cameo of some sort." And I said, "Well, yeah, that'd be nice." It turns out that Ron Howard's family is in most of his movies. If you saw Apollo 13 and you saw the person who played my mother towards the end of the movie, that was Ron Howard's mother. If you saw the minister in the movie who was gathering the astronaut wives around praying for safe return, that was Ron Howard's father. If you saw actually the person at the console who had a speaking part and is also an actor, Clint Howard, that was his brother. And if you had to be very, very sharp, and on the launch scene, and as the two principal wives come over and the reporters go over to interview them, if you look behind that or beyond that, and you see a nun pulling a little kid around the parking lot, that is Ron Howard's wife and his son. So, I mean, he makes a family movie out of these whole things. So he said, "Would you like to be in this movie too?" And I said, "Sure, what can I be?" He said, "Well, why don't you be the admiral that's on board the ship that, you know," and I said, "No." I said, "I retired as a captain. I'll be a captain of the ship." And so that's what happened, and I was in the last little sequence.
So watch for that next time you see the movie, all right? We're going to take some questions from the audience, so if we can have the house lights come up, and we're going to have our folks get out. They do have microphones, and they'll come to you, all right? And we'll see. We've got a few minutes. Speaking of Apollo 13, you actually have to introduce that movie tonight.
Oh, I guess I'm introducing that movie, but I have a sneaky suspicion that everybody who is interested in aviation has seen the movie.
I was wondering if you think that NASA will ever regain the popularity that it held during the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo missions, and what do you think it will take for the public to be interested like it was back in the 60s?
That's a good question for all those of you who heard it. Is the popularity of NASA waning since the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo program? I answer that in several ways. First of all, going into space was quite new. It captured the imagination of just about everybody. You know, we've been thinking about that for many, many years, and we finally got satellites, and then we got Sputnik. And also, there was a great race of between the old Soviet Union and the United States as to who had the most prestige, and the Soviet Union was quite ahead of us. They put up Sputnik, then they put up Yuri Gagarin before we ever could. And so there was a great feeling in this country that, hey, we got to do something, let's get behind it, let's see if we can't get ahead. Then in the Apollo program, when it was announced way back in 1961, and we had not yet put anybody up into orbit at all, either Mercury or Gemini, much less going to the moon on Apollo, everybody suddenly, you know, saw the moon as a great goal, because we have been thinking about the moon for hundreds of years, and people have been writing about going to the moon for 100 years, and suddenly that goal was in the sky that everybody could see on a clear night, you know, all the time. And so this was a great incentive and a great pull to get everybody together to make NASA and the projects very, very popular. But we accomplished those things. We landed on the moon, and we came back, and believe it or not, after we landed on Apollo 11, a lot of the engineers in NASA said, "Okay, hey, done that, been there, let's go someplace else." And the scientists, of course, were madder than hell because, hey, we finally got a transportation device that we could really study the moon and learn more about the solar system and everything like that. I think that NASA has matured. We built the space station. It's been a long time coming. It hasn't brought a return on our investment yet. The people up there are just enough to keep it maintained, to keep it going. We have to still put modules up to complete the space station so we can carry more people up there. I think we have a very dynamic administrator right now at NASA, Michael Griffin, who understands the situation and is trying now to get NASA to keep on looking not just at the space station, which we want to get finished, but also developing the crew excursion vehicle, much bigger vehicle than the shuttle, or actually a lot different. It's going to be one where we're going to land back on water again with parachutes. If you look at the vehicle where the crew is stationed, it's a huge model, not a model, but a part of the Apollo. It's a cone-shaped affair. And so the technique and technologies that we learned in the past that were working fine, we're going to reincorporate them into the new vehicle. And hopefully that we will go on past the space station and go back to the moon first, which will also be a training ground for eventually a trip to Mars. And I think that's coming. If you pin me to the wall and say, well, when, I can never tell you. And you also say, well, what good is it back to the population here that we're going to spend the money to do that? I can't tell you. I know, though, because it's there, and we're a very, you know, I don't want to say aggressive, but I think a very inquisitive society that wants to do things and portray ourselves that we're going to make eventually a trip to Mars. It will not be the United States alone. It will be a consortium of countries that will work together, which will probably, you know, because the Earth is getting smaller with the communications we have, will probably be a very good thing to have a project that will be almost universal.
Over here.
Mr. Lovell, I've read your book many times, and you stated in the end how you envisioned that we should be going back to the moon, and now that reality is going to be coming true from 2010 to 2015. Have you been part of any consulting team with NASA to plan out going back to the moon now with the Ares rocket at all?
I've not been a consultant to NASA. The last thing that NASA wants to hear from is a retired astronaut. I do, you know, I'm privy to everything that's going on, and I learn a lot from what's going on, even the bad things, which I just found out about. So, as far as technical consultants, there's a lot more people, and technology has gone so far from what we were in a, you know, in Apollo, the computer we had was, compared to what we have today, was minuscule. I mean, it was a fabulous little computer that we had in those days, but now they have, you know, with all the electronics and the advancement in computer technology and communications, that I'd be hard pressed to give any kind of a advice that would do any good to NASA.
Okay, over on your left.
Thanks so much, Mr. Lovell, being alive and being an inspiration. Most of my adult life and when I was younger. It's quite a simple question I have is such as, what aircraft, if you're still flying today, and whether or not you're going to be able to be an advocate for the EAA and GA aviation overall to keep it alive and keep it alive with young people like you've done with myself?
The question is, do I still fly? I do. I got my wings in 1954 at Navy. I, of course, flew military until I retired from the Navy and left NASA, and I didn't have access to military planes. Didn't have much money either when I left, but I always wanted to keep flying, and for 16 months I really didn't fly. I would try to con flights out of my friends who had airplanes, and then I told my wife I was going to get a small little airplane, just a little single-engine puck-a-puck that I could, you know, keep my hand in after not flying for a while. And she said, I don't care how good you think you are, I'm not getting in any airplane with less than two engines. and so I eventually had a very good deal. I bought a Cessna 310. I had that for about 5 years. Nice airplane, really loved it. And then four of us had formed a little company and we were doing quite well. So we went out and bought a Conquest, if you remember the 441s. Fantastic airplane, loved it. But when we sold our little company to a much bigger telephone company, and they never had an airplane, that we saw a good reason to sell the airplane to them, which was costing me quite a bit of money every month just to keep it going. So we did that. And then I didn't have an airplane for a little bit. I was flying their airplane. But then I bought a Baron. I had the Baron for about 20 years, an E-55. Great airplane, loved it. And then my wife got a knee replacement. She said, I can't get in your airplane any longer. I had to put my foot on the step and then my other foot on the wing. And I said, I just can't do that any longer, so your flying days are over. So before she could say anything, I sneaked out and bought a 421. That has a door stair, you know. And now she has a nice, comfortable seat, and she can put her feet up on the seat in front of her, and there's a potty back there, which the Baron never had. And so now she's quite happy.
We are just about out of time because you have another appointment to make, but we do appreciate the fact that you have spent this time with us here at Theater in the Woods, and hope you will come back and join us again. But before you go, any final words of wisdom for the assembled EIAers here tonight?
Well, the only thing I can really say is I think that the formation of EAA and what it's doing now for enhancing the idea of flight and the feeling of introducing young people to the field of aviation has been fantastic. I had met Paul Poverinsky years and years ago when I was still in NASA, when he was a colonel in Milwaukee at the Mitchell Field, and when he was still starting this thing all out at Hale's Corners, I think. And I'm really amazed at what's happened so far. It's been really great to be here every once in a while to come back and see the enhancement of this huge organization now and all the chapters throughout the country that are doing a great job to keep the idea of aviation and private aviation especially before the public.
Captain Lovell, thank you, and we hope you will return very soon. Ladies and gentlemen, Jim Lovell.